you take him, life belong me. A hymn in Pigeon taken out of the movie The Thin Red Line soundtrack, and it's a choice of our guest tonight, Richard Carter, Anglican priest and member of the Melanesian Brotherhood.
Perhaps we should begin at the beginning. There'll be plenty of people coming to this story not having read this book.
Yes.
Not having heard anything about the Melanesian Brotherhood.
Yes.
And while it's not the beginning of the story in a sense, why don't we begin where, in a sense, this story starts. Tell me about the events of 2003.
In 2003, the Brotherhood had been asked by the government repeatedly to become involved in disarmament, taking away the weapons which were really holding the country to ransom, which were held in militant hands. This was a political action to get involved in disarmament, because once you start disarming one side, you're always held in suspicion by the other. But in 2002, the community as a whole community decided that there could be no real peace in the islands unless we agreed to take part in that process. And the Brothers have been very successful in people wanting to give up their guns to our religious community. They'd called upon our Brothers to come and take their guns away, and we'd promised them that we would pray with the families who gave up their guns. We would pray for forgiveness. We would take their weapons away and destroy them, and that we wouldn't disclose any names of anybody who'd given weapons to us. And the Brotherhood had collected a phenomenal amount of high-powered weapons. Harold Keke on the weather coast of Guadalcanal wanted nothing to do with this disarmament process. And in Honiara, the Malaitans still believed that unless Harold Keke gave up his guns, there was no reason why they should. The events on the weather coast seemed to be still getting worse. There was a combined operations against Keke and his militant group, and there was news reaching Honiara of villages being burnt down and of human rights abuses on both sides. Our community, again, were the only ones who were willing to meet with Keke and to try and bring about peace, or at least hoping to bring about some kind of way of talking. The Archbishop in Solomon Islands wrote a letter to Keke offering the church to provide mediation if Keke would be willing to talk about peace and about stopping the aggression which was taking place. Two of our brothers went to deliver that letter. One of them returned, but one of them, a man called Brother Nathaniel Sado, stayed behind. About a week later, we heard that he was being held hostage by Keke, and Keke was accusing him of being a spy. The only reason we could think of for this accusation was that Nathaniel Sado was from the same island as the former Prime Minister, Kemakeza. And we didn't believe the story. And we thought that no harm would come to Nathaniel. The brothers had been negotiating with Keke all the way through the troubles for the last 3 years. In fact, when Keke had been ill, he'd called upon the brothers to come and pray with him. So we had a relationship with him, although we knew how dangerous and how paranoid he was at the time. But on Easter Day in 2003, there was a news item on SIBC, the Solomon Island Broadcasting Company, and one of Keke's men had run away to Babanakira, which was a village several miles away from Keke's stronghold, and reported that he'd witnessed Brother Nathaniel Sado being killed over 3 days by Keke's men. I mean, everything changed that day. It was the first time that a brother had ever been targeted. Up until that point, we'd always been seen as impartial, and people, although they may have accused the brothers of taking sides, had trusted the brothers. They were the ones who were considered to be holy men, and to attack them would be to risk the anger of God, if you like, because people believed that they were not involved on either side. Even Malaitans and Guadalcanal brothers had continued to work side by side in our community.
Just to try to place that, in terms of the Solomon Islands and its religious composition, How many people are Anglicans? How many people are Christians?
Over 22% are Anglicans. It's a very Christian country. I mean, most people are practicing Christians these days. I mean, huge church attendance. Like on a Sunday, you would get the church absolutely packed with people and people outside as well. I mean, it really is a very, very actively Christian country. And over 22% of the country would be Anglican, and most of those would pray every Sunday or even every day in the churches.
And Keke himself?
Keke himself claimed to be SSEC, the South Sea Evangelical Church.
But a Christian.
But his Christianity was very much mixed with sort of customary beliefs as well. He did used to make his militant group pray each day, and later on in the story, when he captured some of our novices and brothers, and he made them come and pray with his men and address his men. I mean, he claimed to be a Christian and that he was acting righteously, like many mad men, they claim religious authority.
And the Brotherhood, I think we should also talk a little bit here, just to set this for our audience as well, given that certainly in Sydney, it's not usual to see an Anglican brother. Tell us a little bit about who the Melanesian Brothers are, how many, the nature of the order.
The Melanesian Brotherhood are a group of brothers, an indigenous community founded in 1925 by a man called Ini Korporea, who believed that brothers could take traditional vows of poverty, living without getting paid for what they did, celibacy, so they wouldn't get married while they were brothers, and obedience. They should go wherever they were sent and try and live the gospel in a very direct way. And it was a group that actually managed to convert and live and work alongside many people throughout Solomon Islands and then later Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, and most recently the Philippines. Very much a simple, poor community, but living the gospel in a very simple and direct way. And winning actually the hearts and minds of the people, very popular with the people of the Solomon Islands, who saw them as people who were prepared to come and stay and live in the villages, accept and share the life, and who tried to convert people not by judging them or by the words they spoke, but by the way they lived and by the actions of their lives. So they would help farming, they would help in fishing, they would help build houses, but they would also help solve village disputes and marriage problems. And wherever they went, you know, young people from the Solomon Islands, people were always sort of welcomed them and proud to find brothers in their village.
So the idea of Nathaniel Sado being detained, and in fact reports of him being killed, would have been shocking.
Shocking to the whole many people in the country. People believe that the brothers, there's a word in Pidgin that we use, it that they had mana, they had a spiritual power. People believe that they were people who God listened to. So the brothers were often asked to pray for people who were sick or to, you know, in the old traditional language, to sort of cast out evil or to bring peace to a place. So for these brothers to be attacked, it was quite a traumatic event. It had never happened in the Solomons before that people could remember that brothers were actually attacked in such a direct way or held hostage. The news of Nathaniel's death, you know, did shock many people. And I remember people coming up to me in Honiara and saying, "What's happened? How can this happen? How can the brothers be attacked?" You know.
How were you satisfied that the reports were actually true?
Well, we weren't. I mean, we have a saying in Pidgin of coconut news. Often news travels and it's not the correct news. People invent stories or embellish stories. And I think this is why the six brothers, led by our assistant head brother who was responsible for the welfare of the brothers in Solomon Islands, a wonderful man called Brother Robin Lindsay from Papua New Guinea, from Papandetta. He asked for volunteers and set off with five other brothers to look for Nathaniel. I think he believed that if the stories were true, then he must bring back Nathaniel's body so that it could be buried properly. But we were still hoping and praying at that time that the story was not a true one.
Noel Debien here with you on ABC Local Radio. My guest, Richard Carter, Anglican priest and member of the Anglican Melanesian Brotherhood. You mentioned Brother Robin. He sounds like he might be English also, or an Australian, is he?
No, he was a Papua New Guinean.
I can see that you're actually English, I think, originally, are you? How do you fit into an order which was founded like an indigenous Melanesian.
Yeah.
And it seems to have aggregated also Europeans.
I was one of two overseas brothers, myself from England and a man called Brother John Blythe from Canada. We joined an indigenous brotherhood. I was already a priest and so was Brother John Blythe, but we saw in the lives of this community something that attracted us, something which showed to us a way of living the gospel in a very direct and radical way. And I think in many ways the faith of that community changed our lives. Yeah. And I became the chaplain of the community. So I wasn't in charge of who went where. I was in charge of the spiritual life of the Brotherhood and helping to train them and train them in their educational subjects, like in health care and in Bible study and various other subjects, counselling skills. So I was very much involved in the formation of brothers. But it was an indigenous community. I wasn't the boss, as it were. It was led and run by Solomon Islands, Islanders and Papua New Guineans with great dedication.
Robin went up with five other brothers to find out what had happened to Nathaniel. What happened next?
I didn't know that they'd gone, and if I had known, I think I would have tried my utmost to persuade them not to go, because I knew that if Keke had taken Nathaniel hostage, then the paranoia would have increased, and if he had killed Nathaniel, or Nathaniel had been killed, then the lives of those six brothers who went to look for him would be very much in danger. I had a dream in the middle of the night, a couple of nights later, and this may sound far-fetched, but no, because I'm not usually a person who sees things happening, but I had a dream in which I woke up and I could hear Brother Robin as if he was sobbing, like he was facing something very dark or very evil. And the nightmare was so strong that the next morning I went to the head brother. I said, "Do you know where Brother Robin is?" And the head brother said to me, "He's gone to the weather coast to look for Brother Nathaniel." Later that day in town, I radioed through to the weather coast, and there was a police post there which had a radio, and they said that they'd seen the brothers arriving and leaving their canoe on the beach very near Keke's camp, and they'd seen those brothers heading up towards Keke's camp and being surrounded by Keke's men who were holding guns. I mean, my heart missed a beat. I thought, you know, this was, I thought, I hoped, and I think the community hoped, that they had actually gone to the households on the weather coast, but in fact they'd gone directly to Keke himself. In hindsight, people said, was this a reckless action? But all the way through the Troubles, for the last 3 years, the brothers had been taking actions which were radical.
Collecting guns, collecting weapons, negotiating.
With Keke, negotiating the release of people who'd been held hostage, finding bodies of people who'd been killed, crossing the barricades of both militant groups again and again and again. And this was the kind of the faith they had. They believed that they must go and look for their brother. I mean, the gospel says, if the sheep is lost, go and look for the one that's lost, and they'd done that. So we could hardly turn round and tell them that was reckless. That was what our faith proclaimed in many ways, that we must love the one that's lost.
What was next in the story? You heard the reports that the brothers had been seen surrounded.
We later got a letter from Keke, passed through the police commissioner, that Keke was holding all of the brothers hostage, and that if anyone tried to find them, or if there was any further government move against Keke, they would be executed. And we began a three-month wait, during which we kept a vigil for them, praying through the night. Brothers put their names down on lists and kept praying for them and believed that they would be released. And I think their story was taken up all over the world. I mean, people heard about the brothers being held hostage, and suddenly we found not just Christians but people all over the world sending us messages of support and hoping that the example of these brothers and their way of peace would actually win through. But things got worse rather than better. About a month and a half later, we heard that Keke had, his men had advanced right down to Babanakira and Marassa, and that our brothers and novices who'd been working there had also been taken hostage. And there had been a terrible execution in Marassa where two young boys had been tied up and executed in front of the whole village, and our brothers and novices have witnessed that. Keke released some of them, but held on to another seven of our community. So it felt like from a community that had been very much respected and loved, we were now being directly targeted. And it was during that time, that time of prayer and that time of not knowing who to turn to or where to go, that we began to hear news that possibly Australia was changing its policy towards Solomon Islands, and that there were plans for an intervention force to come to the Solomon Islands. And for us living there, that was almost like a hope that we held on to, that there would be some kind of way of addressing the hostage issue.
Things had gone from bad to worse. As far as you knew, Nathaniel Sato was dead. There were six more imprisoned. There were more taken hostage. What next?
We kept on hoping and we kept on praying. It was a position of complete powerlessness. I've never felt so powerless in my life. I mean, people in a Western world don't understand what it's like when you can't even be seen to talk to a policeman, because that you may be implicated. And so there was no one to turn to. We, the brothers, had been the ones who had always been the ones to help advocate for others. And now when we were in trouble, we found there was no one to advocate for us.
You were afraid even to talk to a policeman.
We were at that stage, because much of the news was getting through to Keke. And maybe the paranoia, that kind of, if you're in a position like that, that kind of fear has an energy, and you don't know who you can trust anymore. I mean, we trusted the members of our own community, but it was difficult to talk to people outside the community because you thought they might be involved with the militant action.
What's the story of Howard Keke and the Malaitans in the nutshell? What is going on? What were you in the middle of?
Basically, Guadalcanal, after the Second World War, became a country where the capital city was developed and grew, the capital city being Honiara, and many migrant workers came to work on Guadalcanal. Many of those migrants were Malaitans from the neighbouring island of Malaita. Malaitans have a reputation of being entrepreneurial, active, energetic. If you were talking negatively, some people would say more aggressive, although I would say that was a sort of prejudiced statement. But they did become the workers in many of the plantations. They helped build the roads and the buildings of Honiara. And the Guadalcanal people were very generous with their land. They often gave away Guadalcanal land for next to nothing. They invited Malaitans to come and stay maybe for a small gift or whatever. And later on, the Malaitan settlements began to grow, not only grow in number, but also grow successful in terms of their projects, piggery projects, chicken projects, plantations and this kind of thing. And Guadalcanal people, not all of them, but some of them, began to grow resentful that we've given our land and here is the migrant worker doing better than we are. And this was exacerbated, I think, with Goldridge Mining Company when the gold mine was opened. And Guadalcanal people said, well, now they're taking the wealth of our land as well, and most of this is going to finance a government which is predominantly Malaitan. I mean, there were, of course, Guadalcanal members, but there was a feeling that a lot of the money was not going to Guadalcanal. In 1999, the militant group began on Guadalcanal, which was called by various names, but one of the names was Issa Tambu Freedom Movement. And at the time, I mean, Solomon Islands was a very harmonious country. I never believed that there would be conflict, certainly not violent conflict. When I first heard of a militant group, I said, oh, this can't happen in the Solomons. And these things happen slowly. They start very small. They start with Malaitan students being threatened in Guadalcanal schools, saying that Guadalcanal schools should be for Guadalcanal people, not Malaitans, and the Malaitan students running away from the school. And then slowly we heard rumours that villages, Malaitan settlements and villages were being threatened. And all of a sudden there were Malaitan refugees flooding into where we were living and asking us to protect them. And we realised that the situation was growing worse and worse.
What size was the Brotherhood at this point, 2003, when...
We had all over the Solomons, we had about 400 brothers, and at Tambalea, where I was based, which is the headquarters on rural Guadalcanal, about 17 miles outside Honiara, there was about 120 novices training. So our community at Tambalea was about 140. But, of course, we were having refugees pouring into Tambalea, asking us to help them get to safety.
Well, this is a relatively large religious community by international standards.
Oh, very much so. It's the largest male religious community in the Anglican Communion. It's very successful, yes.
You're on ABC Local Radio with me, Noel Debien. My guest, Richard Carter, Anglican priest and member of the Anglican Melanesian Brotherhood. Before we diverted into Keke and into the national, the ethnic dispute between Malaitans and the people of Guadalcanal, Nathaniel Sado, the six other brothers, and then more,
yes,
are hostages. What next? You can't do anything. You won't. You can't go to the police, otherwise it might get back to Keke.
We heard that Ramsey was coming. I knew the police commissioner, a man called Bill Morell, actually, who's from Britain. And I heard from him that he was hoping on negotiating in Australia for Ramsey to begin its intervention. And I think that the news of the brothers being held hostage was a catalyst to that movement as well, to the intervention. I think it influenced, certainly your Prime Minister knew about the brothers being held hostage and knew about the situation on the Weather Coast and knew that action was needed immediately.
The murders were reported widely here.
A week before Ramsey was due to arrive, Keke suddenly announced, so it seemed to change his tone completely with our community. He said that he wanted to release the brothers and novices that he was still holding. And I remember waiting on the beach near Honiara as one of the businessmen who worked in Honiara, who Keke trusted, went to collect those released hostages. And we were still hoping that every hostage would be released. And I remember them arriving. First 1 week, a group of three arrived. And then the next week, we were praying that every hostage, every brother would be released. And he sent back another group of three. And I was going, what's happened to the seven? What's happened to the original seven? Are they alive? The latter group to be detained by Keke didn't know anything about the first seven. He said that every time they asked about them, no one answered them. But that Keke was almost like offering a peace offering. He sent these novices and brothers back with gifts for our community. He sent them back with a pig and with shell money, which is in Solomon's a traditional sign of compensation, of trying to make reconciliation. He was obviously nervous about Ramsey arriving, but it was also too as if these brothers and novices had affected a kind of change of heart in his life, because he kept on asking them to pray for him and with him. He lived in the same house as they were living, and he seemed to trust them more than his own men, and then released them and told them not to tell anything bad about him when they went back. But then Ramsey arrived a week later with a large contingent of obviously highly armed soldiers and a big display of authority and power. And I think maybe Australians need to know how wonderful that was for people of the Solomon Islands, that their cry had been heard. And I think that the initial intervention was carried out with great sensitivity to the culture of the Solomon. Not a bullet was fired, and the Australian-led Ramsey forces never shot anybody or killed anybody. And I think they conducted that initial period of intervention with great foresight, as it were, learning the lessons of East Timor, perhaps. But anyway, a week or 2 weeks after their arrival, I was contacted by Ramsey to say that they were trying to arrange a meeting with Keke on the Weather Coast. And they went in with helicopters and they went in with a show of force. They had a frigate waiting off the shore of of the Way of the Coast to show Keke that they meant business. But they arranged a meeting with him, and which they claim that Keke conducted quite honourably. Keke was a very skilled militant fighter. He was extremely capable of inflicting a lot of damage. He was well-armed, his militant group highly disciplined, and he apparently, according to all the reports I heard, he could have fought on for a long time. He knew the terrain, and he had a good sense of what was happening and information. In fact, he always seemed to be able to know what people were going to do against him before it happened.
Why do you think he didn't?
If you ask people in the Solomon Islands, they'll say that, you know, the prayers of the community and the brothers being held hostage had changed his heart. Coupled with that, there was a display of force from Ramsay soldiers, which I think impressed Keke. He could see that they meant business, and he trusted them. He trusted those negotiations, and he kept his word. When they came back the first time, I said, well, you know, why didn't they arrest him? And they said no, that they decided to continue negotiations with him because he'd promised that all his men would lay down their weapons. And people said he'll never keep that. But a week later he did, and I think about 40 or 50 of his militant group held down his weapons. And he handed himself and the ringleader handed himself over into police custody. And he announced that the seven brothers were dead, all seven. So we had this news of his surrender, but we also had the news that all seven brothers had been killed, and they'd been killed on arrival. So for 3 months, the story that they'd been held hostage had been a fabrication. We believed that perhaps Keke was trying to atone for what had happened. Of course, they have never admitted that. But to kill seven brothers in cold blood, in Solomon Islands, a group who had always lived and worked for peace, was a massive thing.
Did you know these brothers?
Knew them really, really well. I'd worked with Robin Lindsay for more than 12 years. Robin was an amazing man, a man of great courage and a great dedication. He was, when he shook your hand, he almost broke your knuckles. He was always there. Whenever you went off on a mission, he was there to take you, he was there to wait for you. I called him the encourager. I greatly loved in Papua New Guinea by the Papua New Guinean brothers, and adored in Solomon Islands. And the idea that this strong man had been killed was unthinkable. And Brother Francis Toffey, he'd been offered a scholarship to Geneva because people had heard the Bossy Peace Institute about his work. He had a great gift of being both very courageous but also very humble. And for a year he'd lived 2 miles away from Keke's stronghold or militant camp and spoken out against violence, refused to let any militant enter the area where the brothers were living with guns, making them put down their guns before they talked with him. He'd refused to take orders from Keke. In fact, Francis, wherever you go, people talk about his courage and the way he actually saved people's lives from the militants and rescued hostages. And I met him 3 days before he was to die. I mean, I didn't know he was going to die then, but I knew that he was in danger because he'd been outspoken in his work for peace and he'd been critical of Keke and the militants. And I said to him, Francis, be careful. I said, if they have killed Nathaniel or if Nathaniel is dead, your life too will be in danger. And he said to me, they called me chaplain because I was the chaplain. Like, chaplain, I would be, I'd be frightened if I was doing something evil, but I'm not frightened to work for peace. And he really believed that. His death was an incredible tragedy for our community, I mean, as was all of their deaths. I mean, I could tell you about all of them. Tony Sirahi was an orphan who joined our community when he was still young. His father had been lost in the bush and they'd searched for him and never found him. And Tony came to live with our community when he was a young, small lad and grew up with us all and then wanted to become a brother and became a brother and became the kind of brother that everyone wanted with them. He was very kind. I remember a time when I was out on one of the islands of Lord Howe and there were thousands of mosquitoes biting us to such an extent that no one could sleep. And he was so worried that I would be bitten by mosquitoes that all night he just kept lighting this fire to try and keep the mosquitoes away. And I remember waking up about 3 o'clock in the morning and still seeing him trying to keep the mosquitoes off me. He was just a very kind man. Alfred Hill, another of the brothers to die, and the story of his death was tragic. They say they beat him and shot him in the arm, and he was in great pain when he died. Alfred Hill was the youngest of the group, very vague. He'd studied malaria research, and so if you had malaria, he could check your blood on a blood slide to see if you had malaria, and he also looked after our guest house. He used to give up his bed if there were too many guests, and I always used to see him sleeping on the floor in the corner, saying, "Why are you down there?" He said, "Oh, too many guests, Father, you know." He was a good lad, a really good lad, and he should never have gone. I mean, he was the guest brother, but he volunteered. He said he wanted to go and look for Nathaniel, and he took that place.
There are two more. Name them both. Tell us just something about them.
Ini Peritabatu. I was a drama teacher before I joined the community and became a priest. He was a great dramatist, very outspoken. I called him the prophet. He used to speak. He was from the area of Guadalcanal where Keke was from, and he spoke out against human rights violations, very outspoken, and a wonderful dramatist and an actor. And Patterson Gatu, who we called the Smiler because he was always joking and laughing and very fearless. I saw him not long before he was to die, and he told me about being shot at on the weather coast of Guadalcanal. He said he'd tried to land his boat and they'd shot at him, and he was just laughing and said, "Oh, the bullets will never hit me, Father. I believe then and I believe now." And I said to him that, you know, bullets can kill whoever you are, you know, however religious you are. And that's one of the things that I think was a turning point in our theology and in our faith, that our faith was not about magically being protected by God, but it was actually about living our witness in a way which meant like the great, well, like Christ himself, like the martyrs, actually having to be present in times of suffering and to be threatened by that suffering ourselves.
You've given some detail about how those men died. There were eyewitnesses.
Yes.
What has happened since?
Keke handed himself over, and I think the Australians have gone to incredible expense to ensure that those trials were conducted, you know, according to Western standards. So it has taken a long time of witnesses and court cases. Keke has been convicted of murder on several counts. So has his henchman, Ronnie Carr, who was a very violent man. And they are now in prison for life with several life sentences on their heads, I think.
And the brothers, I think many of us wondered, with so many killed outright, what happens to an order when this happens in terms of hopefulness, in terms of confidence, in terms of faithfulness. What's happened?
I think there was a kind of a sense in which all of us believed that those seven brothers were examples to the nation. When we held their funeral, thousands of people came into the streets and came to Tambalir to witness the death of these brothers. And since their death, their graves have become a place where many people visit to ask for forgiveness. And I think in many ways as a sign of hope for the Solomon Islands, because you always, you know, bad news always travels, but alongside the atrocities, there are these incredible people of faith who were prepared to risk their own lives because they believed in peace and because they believed in living a Christian life, a life which involved risking those lives, but because they wanted peace for their nation and because they believed in reaching out to both sides. So I think all of us think, when we think of those brothers, is this is where we would like to stand. I mean, no one wants their lives curtailed at a young age like that. It was the most painful thing in my life to try and explain to their families and friends what had happened. And yet, if I had the courage, I would like to think that, given the choice, I would be able to, or other Christians would be able to live a message of peace in the same way.
This was your job as priest and chaplain? to explain to the families?
Yes, it was, and it could easily. I mean, at the time, I thought to myself, how does one explain to families, especially in the Solomon Islands, where it's so easy for misunderstanding to grow? But
what did you say then?
Well, I remember going to Papua New Guinea, and I'd heard to tell Brother Robin Lindsay's family. Of course, they already knew. The news had travelled quicker than I had. But I remember going, and I remember people warning me that Papua New Guineans could get very aggressive and very angry, that maybe I was in danger going to meet with them. And so I went with some trepidation, but especially fearing having to tell them that story, which was such a tragic story. And I remember arriving in Robin Lindsay's village in Port Moresby, and arriving in a car and looking up, and they had made a flower arch for me. And I walked into the village, and his sister and family came up and put flowers around my neck. And I thought, what's happening here? It was just the opposite of what I was expecting. And they hugged me and then started weeping and said they were just so pleased I'd come. And instead of me ministering to them, it was like they were ministering to me. It was just amazing. And I think they were like their brother. They were people of love. And they said that Brother Robin would always be for them a peacemaker. And they came to Solomon Islands and was part of the funerals where Brother Robin was laid to rest with his fellow brothers. And that was the story for all the families. They all supported the community. No one turned against us. They all saw the offering that their sons had made as something of God.
Let's conclude with a piece by Carl Jenkins, Benedictus from the Armed Man Mass for Peace. It's the selection of our guest Richard Carter, the author of In Search of the Lost, a book that recounts the story of the murder in 2003 of seven of his friends, members of the Melanesian Brotherhood in the Solomon Islands. Richard Carter, thank you for joining us on Sunday nights.
Thank you.